This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Support for the world comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
Delegates from the Taliban are meeting with Western powers on European soil. The Taliban want legitimacy on the world stage. Some say they won't find that in Europe.
Legitimacy doesn't really, at the end of the day, come from the foreign governments. It comes from their own people.
Also on the show, when panic gripped Wuhan, a worldwide team of volunteers sprang into action.
I think that this is the group of people informally become an EMT. Emergency response team.
2 years on, they look back at their efforts. I'm Marco Werman, and where is Chinese tennis player Peng Shuai? Don't ask at the Australian Open.
I find it really, really cowardly. This is not a political statement. This is a human rights statement.
Tennis Australia now says, go ahead, ask. All ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. It took more than a decade of legal wrangling, but in a courtroom in Guatemala, indigenous women found a measure of justice this week. They watched as five men who had raped them some 40 years ago were found guilty of crimes against humanity. The crimes took place during their country's long civil war. After the verdict, some of the women broke into tears. Maria Aguilar Velasquez is a Maya Quiche historian at Yale. She was in the courtroom for much of the trial and joins us from Guatemala City. Just a warning, we will be discussing some disturbing details brought up in these cases. Please take care while listening. Maria Aguilar, many of these women, the plaintiffs who were victims of these crimes, many are now in their 50s and 60s. What have they alleged happened to them during the brutal civil war?
The women have been fighting for many years to have their stories believed and to take their case before a judge. Their story is that in the 1980s, their husbands were disappeared, and civil patrolmen and members of the Guatemalan army arrived to their communities. They were raped by members of the army and by civil patrolmen, and then forced to be domestic slaves for them in the military encampment.
So basically, they were targeted once their husbands were gone.
Correct. But this is not just a story about sexual violence against women. This is part of a larger story of counterinsurgency in Guatemala. All of these women come from the region of Rabinal in the department of Baja Verapaz. This is a region that in the 1970s was fighting for land because the Guatemalan government, with funding from the World Bank and the Inter-American Bank, were financing the construction of a dam, of a hydroelectric dam at that time, which meant that many of these indigenous communities would have to relocate, which is something that they did not want to do. So a lot of them started fighting for their land, opposing the government and opposing the construction of this dam. This led to the murder and disappearances of a lot of the husbands of these women, which then led to the sexual violence that they had to endure.
So the paramilitaries who raped these women, they lived in the same town. You've done a lot of research in that part of Guatemala. How did these sexual assaults change the lives of these women and the wider community?
The perpetrators in this case, as you mentioned, the civil patrolmen, are from the same region. This was part of a military strategy. This basically turned indigenous men into perpetrators. which makes it a lot harder in the post-war era to discuss the violence, to discuss responsibility. And as we saw in this trial, it confronts family members. One of the women was accusing a family member of being the one who raped her. So it basically destroys the social fabric of this community.
What kind of social stigma got attached to these women as a result of what the soldiers had done to them? And does that ever go away?
A lot of these counterinsurgency campaigns had a Machiavellian essence to them. The state knew what it was doing. By raping these women and doing it in such a public manner, communities didn't know how to deal with those events. And that is something that is going to take a long time to disappear, and I don't know if it ever will. We need to be able to talk about the past, to talk about what happened, to talk about the violence, and to also enact justice. Here in this case, there were five patrolmen who were convicted because they were the ones who were recognized by the women as the perpetrators. But there are higher ups in the Guatemalan army who are still free, who some of them died without having to pay for the violent acts that they committed.
Given how rare it is, I mean, what does this whole case and this verdict say about impunity among high-ranking officials in Guatemala?
I think it says a lot about the women and the indigenous survivors who are fighting for this. We as women are aware that our life is not worth much here in Guatemala. This was a verdict that took 40 years for these women. This is not a verdict that was given to them. This is something that they fought for.
Maria Aguilar Velasquez is a Maya Quiche historian at Yale. She joined us from Guatemala City, where a court has recently sided with indigenous women raped during the country's civil war. Maria Aguilar, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
In Eastern Europe, Russian and Ukrainian troops stand at the ready, and NATO looks on. Will the outcome be diplomacy or war? Yesterday, we tried to find out how Ukrainians are feeling right now about the prospect of a Russian invasion. Today, we turn to a view from Russia and Denis Volkov. He's the director of the Levada Center, an independent polling and research organization based in Moscow. Denis, according to the polls, what do Russian people want right now?
Well, it's complicated because when we ask about whether Russians expect war or want war, the majority, of course, don't want any war. But at the same time, as the majority of Russians put the blame, this situation, to the United States, because of this, many say that we are being dragged into the war. NATO and the United States, they push Ukraine, and Russia would be expected to step in to defend. As a result, we see rather fatal moods that the war is nearer and nearer, and the fears of war are on the maximums. About 56% Russians say that they fear of war, of big war, and this is among the top fears Russians have right now.
How would a potential war with Ukraine affect President Vladimir Putin's approval rating in Russia?
Well, for now, we see that the conflict is not affecting the ratings of Vladimir Putin or the authorities. They are actually going down a little bit.
And weren't they already kind of on the slide down before?
They were already on the slide down for 3 years. And now, again, they're going down a little bit, but there is no conflict. Usually when we see the conflict where Russia participates, we can remember Georgia in 2008 or Ukraine in 2014. These conflicts boosted popularity of Vladimir Putin, of the authorities, rather considerably.
Generally, in terms of how Russians view Ukraine and Ukrainians, a place and people that Vladimir Putin stakes a historic connection to, I mean, that connection, how has that changed for Russians since the conflict with Ukraine started back in 2014 with the annexation of Crimea?
Well, this conflict certainly draw two countries apart. more Russians now are more negative, not only towards the government of Ukraine, but also rather cold towards the Ukrainians themselves, but still they view Ukrainians positively. But also this conflict affects the understanding of the country itself, that much more people now see Ukraine as a separate country, as a different country, an independent country. So this conflict established this understanding more prominently.
Do your data show anything about how Russians relate to the U.S. or to the West, and how has that changed since 2014?
Well, of course, the peak of negative feelings towards the United States came in 2014 and 15. Then we see how gradually the attitudes towards the United States improved. I think more people now look positive on the United States, especially young generation. And I think that the negotiations and the meetings that started first between Putin and Biden, and then among different delegations, it's affected these attitudes. Because even amidst the rather tough words on both sides, we see that the attitudes improved a little bit more again, in spite of all the conflict going on.
Denis Volkov is the director of the Levada Center, an independent polling and research organization based in Moscow, giving us his take on Russian public opinion as tension mounts between Russia and Ukraine. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For soccer fans worldwide, the Africa Cup of Nations tournament is a must-see. And this year, for the first time in half a century,
we are live from Yaoundé. In Cameroon, round of 16, Cameroon versus Comoros.
Soccer powerhouse Cameroon finally got its turn to play host. Spoiler alert, last night Cameroon defeated Comoros, the island nation in the Indian Ocean, moving Cameroon onto the next round. But it was not by any means a perfect night.
Now to sad news. Reports in Cameroon say 8 people, including 2 children, have now died following a stampede outside the Elembe Stadium in the country's capital.
Sports journalist Leocadia Bongben was at the game last night and joins us now from the stadium in Yaoundé. Leocadia, this was an important match for Cameroon, but one that ended in tragedy. At what point in the game did the stampede start, and do we know what caused it?
It was actually before the game started. There was a huge crowd really coming to the stadium, and I feel at a point the security officials could not handle it. So people started, you know, pushing to get into the stadium.
From where you were in the stadium, did you know at the time what was going on?
Yes, I was actually outside the stadium. All of a sudden, there was noise. And after that noise, when we tried to get closer, we were stopped by the security officials who could not let us go any further. And after that, an ambulance came in. And it's at halftime that there was an announcement that 7 people had already died from the pushing.
So Cameroon, a soccer powerhouse in Africa and the world, it had waited 50 years for the honor of hosting the Africa Cup of Nations, but yesterday was such an awful situation.
Yeah.
Just deadly. What are people talking about today?
In the quarters, the talk is about the stampede. So that's the worry of many people here. The entrance did not allow for so many people to be getting in at the same time. And they are really very sad that this could happen, you know, in a match. People don't go to watch a match and die.
No, for sure not. You're at the stadium right now, Leocadia. There's a game tonight. What's going to be the mood tonight and for the rest of the tournament?
It's something we need to see, because that one yesterday was a Cameroon game. And, you know, as host, supporters normally would want to go and see their team play. Because, you know, it's like we have 20 or 22 million Cameroonian coaches. Everybody's talking football in their little quarters. But today we have Morocco and Malawi. You know, the fans are not so many in the stadium, so we don't know yet.
I'm curious, Leocadia, have you heard what yesterday's tragedy could mean for the Africa Cup of Nations in the years ahead, and how host countries will have to ensure better stadium security?
So from now on, security is going to be tight. And for the country, it's something that may keep some people away from the stadium, especially when they think of what happened to others. Because I actually saw a family, a mother and her children. And I don't imagine that that kind of family will want to go again to the stadium.
Sports journalist Leocadia Bongben speaking with us about the deadly stampede yesterday during the prestigious Africa Cup of Nations tournament hosted this year by Cameroon. Leocadia, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Are the Taliban getting legitimacy by talking to foreign leaders? That's up next. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. For the first time since the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan last summer, their leading officials are having meetings in Europe. A Taliban delegation arrived in Oslo, Norway, over the weekend. They're there for 3 days of talks with Western officials and members of Afghan civil society. The meeting has received a lot of condemnation. Many say the talks give legitimacy to a group that came to power through violence and that continues to oppress much of its population. Joining me now to talk about this is Laurel Miller. She's the director of International Crisis Group's Asia program, where she follows Afghanistan closely. Laurel, how exactly were these talks facilitated? Was anyone pushing for them to happen?
Well, the Norwegian government was the main actor who was creating this opportunity. I don't know that I would say pushing for them to happen per se, but trying to contribute to stabilizing the situation in Afghanistan by fostering dialogue among Afghans and between the current de facto authorities in Afghanistan and representatives of the international community.
I mean, obviously, the Taliban are hoping for potentially better relations with the West and an unfreezing of financial accounts for Afghanistan as the economic situation there gets more desperate. Looking on the optimistic side, what is the likelihood this could happen anytime soon? And do you think these talks might be the start of that?
This is a number of steps that have been taken recently toward a kind of pragmatic engagement with the Taliban, not recognizing them in an official sense, but recognizing the reality that they are currently the rulers of Afghanistan, that Afghans have no choice but to live under a Taliban-ruled state, and that the Afghan people are just in dire economic and humanitarian straits right now and need support. So I would say on the international side, on the side of Western governments, including the United States, there's a kind of feeling the way towards what could be a pragmatic engagement that prevents a failed state in Afghanistan without being too accommodating of the Taliban.
So let me just clarify that. Do you think the international community is eventually going to be forced to recognize a Taliban almost by default, or do you think this conference is really intent on offering an organized path to legitimacy?
I think they're going to have to, unless they want to see a failed state in Afghanistan, they're going to have to work with rather than against the reality that the Taliban is now in charge and there are currently no serious threats to Taliban's grip on governance and rule in Afghanistan. That doesn't mean you have to give them a blank check in any regard. It doesn't mean that you have to officially recognize them. But again, unless you want to see a failed state and the perpetuation of the economic and humanitarian disaster, and that was precipitated to a considerable extent by Western policies, then you're going to have to accept the reality of Taliban rule.
Do you think a failed state is the kind of eventual conclusion if the global community does not engage at all with the Taliban?
I think it's a real risk. There can be mitigation of that through the provision of humanitarian assistance, which is going on right now. Food aid, other forms of basic needs assistance is being provided to Afghans. But at the end of the day, Afghanistan needs some semblance of a functioning state if there's going to be stability there.
Foreign policy expert Laurel Miller, she's the director of International Crisis Group's Asia program. Laurel, thank you very much for helping us understand this.
Thanks for having me.
This month, Spain became the first European country to keep official statistics of femicides. These are hate crimes defined as the intentional murder of a woman because of her gender. In Spain, each time a woman is murdered, her case will now be reviewed by a special committee to try and assess whether gender was part of the motive. Still, activists say simply counting femicides is not enough. From Barcelona, the world's Lucia Benavides reports.
78 women were killed in Spain in 2021 as a result of gender violence. That's according to a Spanish organization called Feminicidio.net, which takes into account a variety of cases, including women killed by their partners, sex workers killed by their clients, and trans women killed in transphobic attacks. The organization has been publishing its annual statistics since 2010, in the absence of official data from the Spanish government. But that's all about to change, says Ángela Rodríguez from Spain's Ministry of Equality. She says it was long overdue for Spain to have an official toll of femicides. With this new measure, the Spanish government is also expanding its definition of femicide. Until this year, it only included women killed by partners or ex-partners. Now, government statistics will include murders where gender is believed to have played a role, regardless of the relationship with the killer. Rodríguez says recognizing these crimes is an important step towards passing policies that combat gender violence.
Que lo que no se nombra no existe. Nos ayudan a visibilizar una realidad que en muchos países sigue estando oculta.
If we don't name it, she says, it's like it doesn't exist. She says, we're shedding light on a reality that continues to be hidden in many countries. The term femicide first began circulating in Latin American countries in the 2010s as a response to the high number of women and girls murdered there. The anti-gender violence movement grew in places like Argentina, Mexico, and Chile, drawing hundreds of thousands to the streets to demand more protection for women and stricter legal action against the killers, who were often given light sentences. This eventually led to legislation in 20 Latin American countries that make femicide a specific crime, similar to the approach Spain is now taking. But Professor Patsili Toledo, who teaches gender in the criminal justice system at the University of Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona, says criminalizing femicide only gets at one part of the problem.
Every time that we have a woman who has been killed, we have a number of institutions, a number of services that probably knew about the situation and in many cases did not act.
Toledo says looking at each killing as an individual case makes it difficult to see the bigger picture of systematic violence against women and the failure of public agents like the police and judicial courts to prevent such deaths.
We are failing when these crimes are committed.
Spain's gender violence law, passed in 2004, provides some protection and support for women, but only if the violence is at the hands of their partner or ex-partner. And to access those resources, they often have to file a police report. Toledo says that can be dangerous for many women. Aggressors are more likely to kill when they feel they're no longer in control. Toledo, who's originally from Chile, says that's especially true for migrants.
Migrant women are overrepresented among the victims of femicide, probably mostly because we lack social networks that protect us.
She says that while the notion of femicide has helped make society aware of widespread violence against women, the focus shouldn't just be on the women who've died, but on protecting those who are still alive. For The World, I'm Lucia Benavides in Barcelona.
You're listening to The World. In Turkey, a massive lake is vanishing and taking away critical habitat for flamingos and their young.
If no water, no baby. If no water, no future.
But some Turks argue it's not too late for people to change their ways and save the lake. Also ahead, Portuguese electronica that takes us way back in history for inspiration. That's all still to come here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. 2 years ago this week, the Chinese city of Wuhan went into lockdown. As hospitals began to fill with patients sick with COVID, medical workers made public appeals for urgently needed masks and other protective gear. A network of Chinese people around the globe went into action. The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai has a story of one such group that still stays in touch.
It started from a simple text between friends. Clement Dai had just landed at JFK Airport, back from a trip to China.
A simple text, and she asked me, hey, do you know where to find medical supplies, surgical masks, anything can be helpful.
The text was from Dai's friend, Joyce Ma. They knew each other from Harvard Business School. She was living in China and getting bombarded with messages about Wuhan.
The situation in Wuhan is really, it's a serious problem. So we need the PPEs.
It was late January 2020, when news of the SARS-like virus was still more rumors than reported facts. Clement Dai and Joyce Ma were among scores of Chinese people across the globe getting increasingly worried about what was happening and trying to figure out how they could help. Like many others, they started to take action. They reached out to their contacts and quickly mobilized them into a group. Within just a day, the team set up a global marketplace connecting vetted suppliers with hospitals in China that needed masks, gloves, and hazmat suits.
We literally made a company overnight.
They called themselves the Wuhan Task Force. And Nikki Zhou, based in the U.S., was one of the first members.
You know, we had shifts. You sign up for each shift. Because everybody had a full-time job or they were a student. Like, it's like you're working at McDonald's and you have like different two-hour shifts increments.
She and others, who were all in their late 20s and early 30s, kept their operation going 24 hours a day. They organized themselves into teams. One to find suppliers, one to work with donors, one to connect with hospitals in China, and others to handle transport logistics and quality inspection. Joyce Ma in China says volunteers were glued to their phones and barely slept.
I have maybe 3,000 or 5,000 messages when I wake up and start to work.
The project lasted less than 2 months. But in that time, the Wuhan Task Force had brokered the purchase and donation of more than $1.5 million worth of masks, gloves, and other PPE, and delivered it to hospitals in China. Last November, Ma decided to organize a reunion of the Wuhan Task Force volunteers in Shanghai. Some of them had never met in person before. Ma says it felt like she was meeting old army buddies. Working with them was life-changing, she says.
It was the first time in my life that I worked with people with no other thoughts, but only how we can do it better, how we can do it quicker, how we can do it more efficient and to help more people.
She says they were all motivated by the same desire to do the right thing.
So when you put something bigger than ourselves, helping others, and when this help could save their life, it's a totally different experience and feeling. So when I experienced this, I could never turn back.
Clement Dai says members of the Wuhan Task Force have come to see each other as a support network for other potential projects.
I think that this is the group of people informally become an EMT, emergency response team. And I think that helping mentality is very essential for everyone in their respective organizations.
Dai believes that regardless of the careers they pursue, people in this group will be thinking about how they can work together to have a positive impact on the world. And the fact that it all started with a text has taught them how easy it can be to start taking action. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Tennis Australia is having a PR problem. First, it was a Novak Djokovic drama, the will-he-play, won't-he-play status of the world's men's number one in the game, someone who also happens to be unvaccinated for COVID. The Australian government eventually said Djokovic could not play in Melbourne and had to leave the country. Now the controversy is about T-shirts. Last Friday, security staff at the Australian Open told spectators to remove T-shirts that read, "Where is Peng Shuai?" They also confiscated a banner with the same words. Peng Shuai is the Chinese tennis player who disappeared for weeks after she accused a top Chinese official of sexual misconduct. In a statement, Tennis Australia defended the ban on the T-shirts, saying it's been a long-standing policy not to allow signs or clothing that's political or commercial. Tennis great Martina Navratilova tweeted, "That's just pathetic." On Sunday, she went on the Tennis Channel to weigh in.
I find it really, really cowardly. This is not a political statement. This is a human rights statement.
Now, Tennis Australia has backed off. Spectators can put their Peng Shuai T-shirts back on as long as there is no, quote, intent to disrupt. Meanwhile, a GoFundMe page has been set up to print more Where is Peng Shuai T-shirts and pass them out at the women's final in Melbourne. Antibiotics are one of the great marvels of modern medicine, but if they're overused, they can lose their effectiveness. Now we are learning that infections from antibiotic resistance have become one of the world's leading causes of death. That's according to a new study published in the British medical journal The Lancet. Ramanan Lakshminarayan wrote the accompanying commentary for the study. He's a senior research scholar at Princeton University and has long been focused on antibiotic resistance. More fatalities from antibiotic resistance than HIV or malaria. I mean, how bad is it globally?
So antibiotic resistance is now the third leading cause of death from an infectious disease. COVID-19 is number one and tuberculosis is number two. Now, COVID hopefully will cease to be such an important cause of mortality in a year or two. That's what we're all hoping for, in which case drug resistance or antibiotic resistance will be number two. That's a pretty big deal because it's a problem everywhere in the world. It's not just in rich or poor countries. It's in all these countries. The second part of this is that we're going to always need antibiotics. We don't have a good substitute for antibiotics. So we're going to need these going forward. And the problem is only going to get worse as we use more antibiotics and resistance gets worse.
Where in the world are the highest rates of antibiotic use and deaths due to resistant infections?
So India is a big consumer of antibiotics in humans, for instance. But human use of antibiotics constitutes only about a third of overall antibiotic use. Much of the antibiotic use is happening in animals, and that's happening globally. It's happening in the United States, it's happening in China, and across the developing world. Any use of antibiotics, whether in humans or in animals, is going to cause resistance because humans have almost 10 times the number of bacterial cells as we have human cells. Anything that changes that makeup because of use of antibiotics, wherever that use of antibiotics might be, affects us.
So the problem affects rich and poor countries alike. I'd like to start off with the well-off countries, the U.S., for example, where a lot is spent on healthcare, and it seems there is a heavy reliance on antibiotics.
So the average American consumes more than twice the amount of antibiotics every year as the average Swede does, even though the average American is not, you know, twice as sick as the average Swede. There's just this notion that we can pop these pills anytime we have a sore throat or a cold and things will get better. But there's also now increasing use of antibiotics in animals because one of the big defining trends of our lifetimes is that much of the planet is starting to eat more meat. You know, the average person in China, for instance, now consumes 6 or 7 times the amount of meat that they would have about 20 years ago. And that means that a massive amount of antibiotics are now going into the food production system. And unless we change that mindset, we're not really going to make the progress that we've seen, for instance, in Europe, where they've managed to cut down antibiotics significantly, both in animals and in humans.
Here in the U.S., of course, we need a doctor's prescription for an antibiotic. How easy is it to purchase antibiotics in other parts of the world?
You could just step in a store and just buy an antibiotic in most parts of the world outside of Europe and the United States, which is really a problem because effectively people are self-prescribing. In China, for instance, hospitals make their revenues from the sale of antibiotics. So it's not just someone asking for an antibiotic. The hospital actually has an incentive to give out the antibiotics because that's how they make their revenues. So clearly all of this has to change.
Given your predictions about what this will lead to, what needs to be done?
One is we need to prevent infections in the first place. That means using more vaccines, using better infection control, and better water and sanitation. Now, these apply differentially in different settings. So some places would do very well with better water and sanitation, for instance. And the second thing we need to do is encourage people to treat antibiotics as if they were this magical, very powerful weapon, which is what they really are, and use them judiciously. Very often, people just think of antibiotics as being just like a sugar pill, and they just eat them, you know, without really thinking about the consequences. The third thing we need to do is to develop new antibiotics. Given that there are many infections today that are not treatable with currently available antibiotics, we're going to have to figure out how to encourage industry to make new antibiotics if we are to have any chance of having them be effective for our children and our grandchildren.
So, Ramanan, just some use we can use here. So the next time I'm prescribed an antibiotic, how do I know if I really need it or not?
I think the simplest thing is to ask your provider, do I really need this antibiotic? Providers will offer patient antibiotics if they feel like the patient implicitly expects an antibiotic, even if they haven't even asked for it. So the best thing is to turn around and ask, do I really need the antibiotic? Because keep in mind that your taking that antibiotic also puts you individually at greater risk for resistance. So as much as we can avoid antibiotics that are unnecessary, it benefits ourselves, people around us, and certainly society at large.
Ramanan Lakshminarayan is senior research scholar at Princeton University, speaking with us about the disturbing news from the medical journal The Lancet that antibiotic resistance has become one of the world's leading causes of death. We appreciate your time, Ramanan. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Later this spring, people will have either been infected by Omicron or vaccinated from it, or possibly both. That's what epidemiologist Bill Hanage told our global health reporter, Alana Gordon, during a forum today with Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He also described how different groups of people are faring from the spread of Omicron. If you missed the conversation, watch the video on our website, theworld.org, and listen tomorrow for Alana's report on how long the pandemic emergency might go on. In the plains of central Turkey, there's a lake that's about to disappear. At more than 600 square miles, Lake Tuz was once the second largest in the entire country. It spans an area larger than London. Every year, thousands of flamingos use the warm, shallow water to raise their young. But today, climate change, drought, and intensive water usage are spelling disaster for this critical body of water. The world's Duri Biskaran met one unlikely environmentalist in Oskaray, Turkey, who's determined to save the lake.
As a child, Fahri Tunç would help his grandfather hitch a donkey to a cart, and they'd walk to Lake Tuz from their village to hunt for ducks. Later, when Tunç became a wildlife photographer, the lake became his studio.
I think that I'm crazy, but this is not. I'm really normal person. But when I come to the lake, all my life is changed.
As he photographs the lake, hours pass by without him noticing. The water stays still and clear, creating a mirror. The mountains surrounding the basin become an earth-toned frame. In the summers, migrating flamingos stop here to lay their eggs and raise their young. They eat a specific type of algae that turns the water pink.
When you see sun and the flamingo the same time, that moment you understand that you are falling in love.
And like falling in love, you'll do everything you can to protect it. Last spring, as the weather warmed, Tunç realized that Lake Tuz was evaporating. The lake recedes naturally every year, but this time it was too fast. He was worried there wouldn't be any water left for the flamingos when they arrived from their winter feeding grounds. Part of the problem was that farmers were diverting water from the canals that normally release water into the lake.
When I see that all canal is blocked, I say, open. They don't listen to me.
Tunç went door to door, asking farmers to stop blocking the water. He begged them to leave some for the birds.
And the farming say that, who is important, my child or flamingo?
Farmers have been reacting to prolonged droughts in central Turkey and much of the Mediterranean by using more groundwater to feed their crops. And Lake Tuz is one of the victims, says Fulya Aydin Kandemir, a water management expert at Turkey's Hydropolitics Association.
Up to 2000, over exploitation began by the people, by the local communities, and the lake begins to disappearing step by step, time by time.
In 2015, Kandemir and her colleagues conducted a study using satellite data to map the annual ebb and flow of Lake Tuz. In August, the lake is at its lowest levels, turning much of the area into salt flats. It's at this point that you can measure the permanent water for Lake Tuz, Kandemir says. But in recent years, it's begun to dry out completely.
That is a disaster for the wildlife and biodiversity richness.
Last summer, on August 13th, Tunç went to the lake one more time. He switches to Turkish, saying the memory is hard to talk about. All around him were the tiny bodies of baby flamingos, dead in the hot sun. Thousands of them. He didn't know what to do, so he took out his camera. He photographed them for hours. From what he could tell, almost all of the dead flamingos were too young to fly. The adults, apparently, were able to fly off and look for water elsewhere. But he saw that one had stayed behind.
I was upset that why is you can fly? You can fly. Why you die? And when I opened the arm, under five baby.
This flamingo died holding its five hatchlings under its wings. All told, an estimated 5,000 flamingos passed away over a period of 2 weeks.
If no water, no baby. If no water, no future.
Today, Lake Touze is a shadow of its former self. A shock of reeds stick up out of the muddy, sunken earth. Where we're standing is supposed to be underwater this time of year. But Tunç has hope. Maybe if nearby farmers switch to drought-tolerant crops, he says. Maybe if we get enough people to pay attention.
I will never forget this period. And who is guilty, I will never forgive.
This year, he says, he's enlisting the help of a foreign company to help him save the flamingos. He says he's prepared to put his home up for sale to finance the project. And even if it doesn't work, he has to try. For The World, I'm Dari Buscarin in Aksaray, Turkey.
Last year, Brazil fought one of the globe's deadliest outbreaks of COVID. Now, once again, Omicron is setting infection records there. But this time, most of Brazil is better prepared. Brazil's largely been praised for its successful vaccination campaign, with rates ahead of the United States, Germany, and the UK. Indigenous Brazilians, though, they've been especially hard hit by Omicron, as misinformation and denialism have weakened vaccination efforts in those communities. Michael Fox has our story.
Vamos vacinar o nosso pequeno e lindo Davi.
A week and a half ago, 8-year-old Davi Seremramiwe Chavante became the first child in Brazil to be vaccinated. In this video of the event, he wears shorts, a palm tree t-shirt, and a white face mask. He takes the shot like a champ before a room full of press in Sao Paulo. His father, the indigenous Chavante leader Jurandir Siridiwe, thanked those involved in a message shared online. May all of the children of Brazil be vaccinated, he said. It's significant that the first child to receive a shot in Brazil is indigenous. Native peoples have been hit hard by the pandemic. Nearly 1,300 indigenous people have died, many of them leaders and elders. Vaccinations are happening, but indigenous peoples are fighting an uphill battle. Last Saturday, under a clear blue sky, a group of adolescents lined up to be vaccinated on Xoclen indigenous territory in the hills of southern Brazil. A group of five nurses administered the shots wearing t-shirts and face masks. The jabs were welcome news, as the Xoclen have had a difficult time lately. In 2020, we practically only had one death, Xoclen leader Brasilio Pripró says. But in 2021, we lost a lot of youth. We lost a 22-year-old girl, a man of 50, someone who was 31 and his brother, and recently a girl who was only 20. So 2021 wasn't very good for us, even though we had a vaccine. The most recent death was just 2 weeks ago. The problem, says Pripró, is that the vaccines are available, but fake news and misinformation have encouraged people not to get the jab. Pripró says, generally the people who died were the people who hadn't been vaccinated. They weren't vaccinated and they got sick. It's a similar story across the country, as Omicron has spread fast along with the flu. According to COABI, the largest indigenous organization of the Brazilian Amazon, only 60% of the residents in some villages are fully vaccinated. That's in part due to messages like this. In a video that's been shared widely in recent days among the Kayapó people in the Brazilian Amazon, President Jair Bolsonaro says that the shot could cause chest pain and shortness of breath. Parents, you have to be conscious of your responsibility in vaccinating or not vaccinating your child, he says. I repeat, my daughter will not be vaccinated. Casusa Benavides is with the Cabo Institute, which represents the Kayapó people.
Entre os Kayapó, menos agora que nós estamos chegando aos 50%.
She says not even 50% of the Kayapó are vaccinated now, and there's been a lot of resistance. What arrives to the people here is largely fake news, videos over WhatsApp, shared in groups, she says. These videos are influential in many isolated communities where people get a lot of their information from social media and evangelical churches. The Cabo Institute and other indigenous organizations have done their best to promote vaccines and respond to the misinformation, holding meetings, health education days, and sharing information online. Indigenous leader Luis Peña blames the government for its lack of support, the slow vaccination campaign, and for spreading misinformation that's costing people their lives. According to reports, 5 members of the Kayapo people died from flu-like symptoms just in the last 2 weeks.
Que nunca a gente consegue ter o de volta ao familiar, né? Então, algumas famílias.
We can never have our family members back, he says. Many family members, many leaders have been lost. The community misses them a lot. That's really hard, he says. The vaccinations of children on indigenous territories are expected to speed up in the coming weeks. In many places, it'll sound something like this. In this video shared online recently, a ring of children sing as health professionals prepare vaccines to be administered in this Tupi Warani village in the state of Rio de Janeiro. But the battle over misinformation will no doubt continue, alongside the vaccines and the spread of the Omicron variant. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
Usually when a DJ says, I'm going to take you back, they mean to the 80s or 90s. To set this up, though, I'm taking you back about 1,200 years. You're hearing a modern interpretation of a Moorish melody. The medieval Iberian Peninsula, what is Spain and Portugal today, had a diverse population, with Moors and Arabs who'd migrated from the Maghreb and North Africa. In the musical culture, the sounds were delicate, emerging from simple patterns that grew more complex. Fast forward more than a millennium, and from Portugal comes the duo Bandua, an electronica ensemble that is plumbing the same source, Moorish culture, following some of the same musical patterns. Bandua takes their musical cues from the central Portuguese region of Beira Baixa. If you want to get to the root of this medieval music, that's where you need to point your ears. Bandua's vocalist Egor Valente and producer Bernardo Daddario, a.k.a. Tempura, have family in the Beira Baixa region, so this track, Cinco Sentidos, or Five Senses, is something of a love letter to their rugged and remote home.
Sinto sentido, já todos vou distinguir e já os levo perdidos. Chuta amor se queres ouvir.
Talk about a song a long time in the making. That's Portuguese electronica duo Bandua doing a rare thing, turning medieval Moorish sounds into modern pop. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Be safe, stay strong. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/theworld. That's odoo.com/theworld.